Nothing in this program should be considered investment advice. It is for educational purposes only. Please hit pause and read this disclaimer in full.
You've got to give the next generation more than just money. You have to give them the emotional strength. You have to give them the fortitude, the problem-solving skills, and the encouragement to fight through hard times, because hard times create better people.
The following is the audio version of a video released at peakprosperity.com. Visit peakprosperity.com to watch the video and to find other insightful content such as articles, discussion forums, and exclusive subscriber-only content.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this episode of Finance U. I'm your host, Chris Martinson, and I'm back with Paul Kiker of Kiker Wealth Management. Hey, Paul, we were having a rocking good conversation there before we hit the record button, weren't we?
We sure were. That was enjoyable.
Well, I'm glad to see we're both smiling because there were some parts of that. So let's get right to it, everybody. Paul, a couple things on my plate today. I don't know what's on yours, but I want to talk about the AI bubble because we have some new creaking and popping sounds coming out of that. And then there's this whole concept of sort of maybe not America first. I feel like there's a really powerful thing going on where it feels like a lot of Americans are saying they feel abandoned now. They feel unrepresented. Mm-hmm. And the reason that's important to me from an economic, a portfolio standpoint, is that Bessent and Trump are attempting to do something really magnificent by their own words. They're going to reshape the global architecture of international trade and the United States' position in that. Well, to do that, I would submit you need strong support, political support back home, and I'm seeing that fray right now, and I think that has consequences, because when you're trying to do something that ambitious, you really need things to go very, very well, and I'm worried we don't have the substrate for that.
Well, correct. There's too much. The division's continuing, and the bitterness back and forth between the parties that he needs, and even within his own party to help, is ratcheting up.
Well, let's turn now to this AI bubble real quick. So I came across this quote from Benjamin Anderson writing Economics and the Public Welfare a long time ago. And he said, every era of speculation brings forth a crop of theories designed to justify the speculation. And the speculative slogans are easily seized upon. The term new era was the slogan for the 1927 to 1929 period. We were in a new era in which the old economic laws were suspended. End quote.
Mm-hmm. Suspended's key. They were suspended for a period of time, but they came back with a vengeance.
Well, didn't they? I mean, listen, we had that. We had the dot-com bubble, right? Oh, eyeballs, right? Then you have your real estate craze, like, oh, they're not making any more land anymore, you know? And then you have where we are right now, which is, oh, this AI thing is going to transform, if not disrupt, everything. And that's fine. That may be a true statement. But you got to show me the money. You have to show me the business model somewhere in there.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There's got to be profits, and it's got to be quick with the amount of expenditure that they're putting out there right now.
Yeah. So I think the new era is coming to a rapidish sort of an end here. Jim Chanos writing here about the CoreWeave story, and this is kind of, let's unpack this for people because it's a little wonkish, but important. He says, as the artificial intelligence DC bulls now try to convince you to extend depreciable lives on the GPUs, those are the core, those are the chipsets that are being sold by, say, NVIDIA. So extend depreciable lives. So they're saying, look, Paul, do these things last 2 years, 3 years, 5 years? How long do they last? All right. They said, consider this. CoreWeave's third quarter annualized adjusted EBITDA, which is earnings before interest, tax, and depreciation. So they haven't even depreciated their chips. This is their earnings before they've accounted for the massive expenditure, CapEx, on the chips. Their adjusted EBITDA was $3.4 billion, and annualized interest was $1.2 billion. So, we're using very high interest debt to support a depreciable asset. So that leaves them about $2 billion left over. So it says, using their 10-year life, 10 years, CoreWeave is saying, oh, we think our chips are going to last 10 years. Everybody says 2 to 5, but 3 is a reasonable app. 10! On their $20 billion of GPUs, $2 billion. So that $2 billion has to be parked out of there. That means they're barely profitable. They're barely profitable, Paul, only if they guess that their chips are going to last 10 years, and they're using high interest debt to float that story.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a little wonky, but that's really clear. This is as close to that funny accounting we saw back in 2000.
Yes.
As we've seen.
Yes. Well, you know, and I read a pretty in-depth article about that last week, you know, and just trying to understand exactly the consequences of that, which means it's, you know, they're playing these accounting games. But when you look at the problem with the funding right now, and Oracle's debt's getting downrated and a few of these others, we're starting to see major cracks around the seams. They've got to play this game if they're trying to get capital to come in, and hoping that they have investors that are oblivious that aren't getting into the details like that. So it's a self-serving mechanism right now, which at the same time rewards your C-suite because their compensation comes from stock. So they've got a vested interest to be as deceitful as possible and keep this thing going as long as they can.
Well, I mean, we talked about it before, but 2000. So, you know, we had the whole internet craze, right? And that really started about 94, built up. We had that scare in 1998 with long-term capital management, but that got quickly papered over by the Fed. And then things carried on from 98 to 99 to 2000 and finally sort of gave up the ghost in March of 2000. Okay. And we talked about it before, and I asked you what was the warning bell. Like looking back, hindsight's everything, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you thought it might have been, if I remember, did you say a Broadcom's earnings report?
I believe it was a Broadcom earnings report, yes. I actually went back and looked at some notes during that period of time prior to that conversation, but I think it was Broadcom that kind of rang the bell at the top. That got everybody paying attention to the details like they're starting to do right now.
Yeah. Well, I just want to bring this up because there's some parallels, but not perfect. So one of the other things that we found once the dust settled in 2000 was there were all these companies making the fiber optic pathways for this new internet highway, right? And so they laid all this fiber optic, which was dark for a long time, meaning there was no traffic going on it. So dark fiber, that was what I recall. So they overbuilt. Right. They just got crazy and they just started laying fiber because, you know, sky's the limit. We had that new era. It was upon us. However, over time, Paul, that dark fiber ended up getting lit. It was maybe too much too fast in the midst of a craze, but it actually had a long term residual value. My question is, if you build too many data centers, what are they good for in 10 years, 20 years? Because some of that dark fiber didn't get lit up till, you know, 10 years later.
That's right. That's a good question. And just the amount of capital expenditure that's going to have to go in to keep up with the new technologies, because you would assume that with the AI data centers, let's say we've got 3 years worth of good growth out of it, and they can help fine tune this information and make better chips as they go along, then you're going to have to constantly compete with these new chips that are coming out.
Mm-hmm.
So massive amount of expenditure. It's not like you've laid this foundation of dark fiber that can be utilized for the next 20 to 30 years. I mean, I think it was last week or the week before we talked about when I built that Ethereum mining rig. It was good for 2 to 3 years, and then the technology was just outdated. So, you know, it's a good question. Unless we're not going to continue to advance going forward, but somebody out there is always going to be trying to advance because they're going to be in a capital position where they can, with those companies that have overinvested, do not have the capital to continue.
Yeah. And Paul, I'm as certain as I can be that 10 years is not a realistic depreciation schedule for these chips.
No, not at all.
It's just not. And by the way, for anybody listening, I am neither advocating for or against any particular shares or anything. These are all just illustrative, sort of educational. This is CoreWeave's stock price. So from a technical standpoint there, Paul, this doesn't look too healthy at present to me.
No.
What are you seeing?
No, that's a major technical sell signal. I mean, you know, you start to retest. You've got a falling trend line. You've got a rising trend line. That's a wedge or a breakdown. High probability at a minimum, you're going to see the lower trend line down there on the bottom, which is green. So that's a good topping pattern. And look at the volume on that sell-off there.
Ooh, yeah. Yeah, that volume's a big indicator to me. Yeah, so it climbed, and it was starting to do it on declining volume right here, as you see it sort of like cut ratcheting up. That's also a sign I look for. Not a healthy sign. That's like, are we topping? Yeah, there's less and less and less interest, and then eventually it sells off. But it was at 185-ish a share, and now it's at 90. So it's about half off where it was, well, just in June.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay. So, all right, CoreWeave. CoreWeave makes a lot of the data centers, all that. But, Paul, what about this? I found this overbuilt. The too much dark fiber. Overbuilt is a sign at the top. So now there's two data centers in NVIDIA's hometown in Santa Clara, California. They're just sitting there. Why? Well, quoting from the Bloomberg article, quote, two of the world's biggest data center developers have projects in NVIDIA's hometown. They may sit empty for years because the local utility isn't ready to supply electricity. Right? Roughly 6 years later, after they built these things, the development remains an empty shell awaiting full energization. Blue Owl Capital has a nearby 48-megawatt project that also is vacant, while the city-owned utility Silicon Valley Power struggles to upgrade its capacity. It's California. Good luck with that. That's going to be a problem because California, hard to get anything done there, obviously. But when your own flagship company has two shells of data centers that they built sitting kind of empty-ish for 6 years because they can't get power, we might be over the tips of our skis.
Absolutely. And just the ridiculous lack of long-term planning that's there. And the one question I'll make from a sarcastic standpoint, if they always have the next generation of AI ahead of what we have out here, how come their AI didn't warn them and say, hey, you got a problem coming in the future. You're not going to have the power to turn into productive capacity this capital that you've expended into this and into these data centers? That's shocking to me, actually.
Well, can you imagine, Paul,
that far ahead?
If you hired a developer to build you a house and they go ahead and they build the house and then they say, I need you to take delivery of it. And you're like, but there's no power connection. And you go, oh, yeah, well, we forgot to ask for that. And there's no more. The local power company can't hook you up for we don't know how long. You'd sue them.
Absolutely. And even, I guess, what was it, the Aldi that we were talking about in LJ several years back? Mm. You know, it was sitting there completed, and they couldn't get the transformers to get in place. And by contract, it cost whatever X amount of dollars per day to the contractor, and they ended up getting it. But, you know, that was a shortage issue, you know, timing. But still, I mean, this is a much more major issue than that because they're not going to be able to solve that power issue quickly, especially in the state of California.
Well, yeah. And by the way, it's not just there. Amazon has two centers also that they can't get fired up because Pacific Corp is facing huge lawsuits and they're not sure what their cash position is going to be. And they can't commit themselves to a highly volatile wholesale electricity market to supply them as contracted. So they're just not doing it. So I think that's another warning sign. So Amazon can't get this energized. And then how about this one? Fermi, this is astonishing to me. A siren's going off. That's the only commentary I could think of on this. So Fermi has a massive 11-gigawatt energy and data center. 11 gigawatts. That's 11 Denvers of electricity in this
goodness
one complex.
Gracious.
11 gigawatts energy and data center project in Texas called Project Matador, which the company has envisioned to be the world's largest AI data center and energy campus in the Texas panhandle, is struggling to close the deal with its first major data center tenant, so no anchor tenant. Fermi's Donald J. Trump campus, I see what they did there, is an array of solar, natural gas, and nuclear power generation, as well as storage, and 2.6 million square feet of data center capacity, 11 gigawatts of power, 6 gigs of nuke, 5 gigs of gas power generation. Unbelievable. Largest advanced energy and data campus in the world, and they can't fill it. They can't get somebody to come in and take advantage of all that awesomeness.
Oh, my. Wow.
And it was set up as a REIT. It's going to allocate income from tenants back to shareholders. So that looks like they did it on an equity deal.
I'm very cautious when it comes to REITs, real estate investment trusts out there, because I've seen a lot of those blow up over the years. A lot.
Yeah, how do they blow up? What's the path there?
Either too much leverage or overestimating what their future income is going to be in the future demand. You know, it's easy to look back in 2006, 2007, because when I first came in the investment industry with the corporate firm I was with, like, REITs are great. These are wonderful things, but they're hard to get out of because there's no liquidity for 5 to 7 years in most cases. So they operate a lot like private equity does from that standpoint. You know, you can only get on a list, and if there happens to be some liquidity, then you can get out. Rarely is there liquidity there for most of these. So a lot of those went public in 2006, 2007. You get your liquidity event, and people will tend to roll them back in. Well, most of those that went in 2007, 2008 blew up. But what people don't understand, there are a lot of real estate investment trusts that blew up in the aftermath that came out in 2013, 14. And it was just overestimation and too much leverage and projecting into the future something that did not happen. And the lack of liquidity means you just can't get out of them.
Unbelievable. So, yeah, we'll keep an eye on that one. Paul, I've got, I think, the final arrow that goes into this AI bubble. We'll get to it as soon as we get back from this break with my favorite sponsor. Markets are facing heightened uncertainty, and thoughtful portfolio management has never been more important. If your current strategy relies solely on passive investing or diversification without active oversight, it may be time to consider a different approach. At Peak Financial Investing, we connect you with experienced wealth managers who actively manage portfolios using disciplined, research-driven strategies designed to adapt to evolving market conditions. Our focus is on helping clients navigate volatility with clarity and confidence. While no investment strategy can guarantee results or eliminate risk, we believe that preparation and active management can make a meaningful difference over time. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com to schedule a complimentary consultation and explore whether our approach aligns with your goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, and I am proud to support Peak Financial Investing. This is not a guarantee of future performance, but a call to take your financial planning seriously. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Investing, of course, involves risk, including the potential loss of principal. Past performance is not indicative of future results. Please consult with a qualified advisor before making investment decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. Paul, so here's the story we set up. We're starting to lay the equivalent of dark fiber, dark data centers. There isn't enough power, but that at least begins to put some sort of like, okay, there's, you know, AI was just this sprawling Wild West. How fast can you build them? But now we're bumping into sort of edges of that story. But, you know, the stock price of certain AI companies like NVIDIA really depend on there being no limits. It's just infinite exponential growth. As far as the eye can see, we're going to double. So given all of this stuff that's happening, here's what NVIDIA's response to all of that has been. They just upped their orders from TSMC, which is a wafer producer, to boost their 3-nanometer wafer output for the Blackwell chips by 50%. They're going to get 50% more chips. They're going to build them faster.
Hey, we're running into issues, so let's just double down and buy more.
Yeah, faster. No, I mean, it's, we've seen this story before.
We have. Mm. And look, I'll tell you one of the biggest concerns that I have about where we are in this cycle. So from time to time, when you're seeing just continued, like, it's not a lot of new news. We're still seeing fraud pop up to the surface over the past week. We're still seeing, you know, consumer sentiment terrible, all kinds of concerning things that are taking place. So I took the opportunity, and in the investment industry, there are wholesalers of these big investment companies, right? And I'm not going to say the name of the company that this guy represents, just to keep it clear, because this is representative of what's taking place in the industry, but they're a large player in the investment world. So what these wholesalers do to advisors is they represent mutual funds, ETFs, private equity, you know, all of these fancy products. So I've known this guy for 16 years. He's dealing with some of the largest firms around. And I asked him a couple of questions. I said, so what's your agendas right now? So he makes some fascinating presentations to us. One, I thought this was interesting. They're adding silver to their target allocation now.
Let's be okay. Sure to talk about that more. Okay.
Yes. So I wanted to plant that seed for later. Two, they're concerned about valuations. Okay. Because everybody's talking about history. Is this 2000, you know, 1929? Everybody has learned in the past that you're not going to say it's different this time. But there's always a slightly different justification. So the argument that they're laying is, look, yeah, there's concern. Valuations are extreme, but we're 2 to 3 years out before we have any major issues. And it may be bad when this is over, but liquidity, the Fed's going to bail us out. Trump's going to do all of these things to try to you know, kick that can down the road. So say, hold that seed for a little bit later. I'll come back to it. Well, I'll jump from that. So other items I'll talk about later. So then I walk out of that meeting and I call a friend of mine who had gone to a state for a due diligence meeting. And he's been in the industry for a long time. Know him, trust him. He's eyes wide open. I'm like, so how was this event? He said, well, this company does try to do some adaptation. They're fully invested at all times, but they'll make adaptations from growth to value to try to preserve some capital if the market comes apart. And in the past, they did pretty good. Market was down 50. They were down 40. Okay. So that's better within a long only space. I said, so what was the pitch? He said, they got up and absolutely stated that this is not going to end well, but we have 2 to 3 years before we run into issues. And, you know, and I got to thinking about that because the Fed stepped in so many times to bail out this market that even I can build an incredible argument that this is going to last for another 2 to 3 years. I don't believe that it will. I'm kind of straddling that fence. I have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us if we do. But here's my big concern. Buffett's the only one that's out there right now that's raising capital. Okay. So he's raising capital, and this is an appropriate time to share this chart. So let me pull this up. So Charlie Bolello quotes what Warren Buffett said here. Having loads of liquidity lets us sleep well. During episodes of financial chaos that occasionally erupt in our economy, we will be equipped both financially and emotionally to play offense while others scramble for survival. Okay, that's so the legend in the investment world right now. Look at the cash pile that he's accumulated and how fast it's accelerated since 2022. Now, if you take that from a backdrop...
Real quick, don't lose your thought, but I just want to point out for people that there's two ways Buffett's been raising cash. One is, you know, if dividends come in, he's just stockpiling them. But the second is they've actually been selling stocks, equities. Yes.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. It'd take me a minute to find that chart. But he's been a net seller of equities for, what, 24 months now, correct? Yep. Going back to about 2022 when he started raising that cash pile. So my concern is... Everybody recognizes it's we have issues, but there's such a fear in the industry from the professional management area because retail is going all in. If you take that path less traveled right now with a lot of these firms, when it's different when you have an advisor that's working with you, okay? If you've got an advisor that's being pitched an investment from the mutual fund company and he has to turn around and meet retail and he can't educate retail on what, yes, he can't educate retail because he doesn't really understand what's going on about the danger of this market. And that client says, well, so-and-so down the street tells me that they can do more. If I'd have gone with so-and-so, I'd done a little bit better. All it is performance chasing. So my concern is everybody recognizes because they understand and they have information of the past. I mean, like we've clearly been warned in 29, the year 2000, 2008, the aftermath or the fruit that's produced by the seeds that have sowed to get the tree to where it is right now, the chaos that comes on the other side. But they're absolutely scared of underperforming because they know they'll pay a price for that and lose some of their clients. I mean, you go back to 1999, this may not be exact because this just came to mind. But if I remember correctly, Warren Buffett lost 30% of his investors in Berkshire Hathaway because in 1999, he lost 20% while the S&P went up 20%. Now, I'll tell you right now, in a year that the market's up this much, because we communicate to our clients, you know, why, if we were down 20%, were the market where it is right now because we were taking that stance, I would say 30% of our clients would fire us because they don't understand why. And maybe I don't communicate good enough, but they're looking around and their brother-in-law is putting pressure on them. So, you know, in this environment... If they actually stood up and said, look, this thing's coming over, we're not taking the risk anymore, we're going to lower and shift over into value, which has just been absolutely taken out to the woodshed and beat this year. Like, our value strategy's up for the year, but performance is horrible. It's just what's taking place in that sector, okay? It's not that the strategy's bad, it's just that investors are selling retail to chase these other stories. that they fully convince themselves that we have 2 to 3 more years. And maybe we do. But I think that's, you know, from the big picture, from 30,000 feet looking around in the industry, you know, convincing ourselves we have 2 to 3 more years. How different is that's no different. It's just it's a different color or a different spin on the fact that it's different this time. Okay. Because 3 years from now, let's say the Fed does something, you know, for whatever, they're able to kick this can down the road a little bit longer. All that means is the consequences are going to be even more severe, but they'll continue to convince themselves we've got 2 to 3 more years. And my biggest concern is there are very few companies out there right now that are going to make any attempt, to lower risk and protect capital for investors. But Buffett is, we are, and will.
So I need to ask you about that because this is really important. So let's say, for people who are just listening, I have a chart up right now that shows that U.S. households, so this is retail, is all in with the highest aggregate equity asset allocation to equities ever, right? Higher than the dot-com bubble, higher than any other time, okay? Very low on cash, very low on fixed income. Okay. So this is sort of that new era idea, Paul. It's a new era. And by the way, I can't blame households because guess what? Their lessons have been that as soon as the precious financial assets start to go down, the Fed will step in and pump them back up again. That's what they've been doing. Of course, that's caused other second order problems like a wealth gap and the fact that almost all those gains go to the top 0.1% and they actually go to people who actually don't have to work for that money, right? It's the financial class, the rentier class, as they say, rentier, meaning you make money off of extracting rents from society without producing anything of value while you're doing that, right? Okay. So given that, let's imagine, Paul, I'm one of these people. I'm nervous. I'm like, right, I've been listening to you, Paul, for a while, and Chris, and I've got my portfolios with a traditional manager, and they're just saying, hey, you know, nothing you can really do. I mean, I'm sort of paraphrasing. They might say, look, you know, markets go up, markets go down, mm-hmm. Market timing's impossible. So just hang on and this will all work out. Tell me, what do you say to somebody who comes to you with that story?
I'll say, yes, market timing is impossible. You're not going to consistently pick the top or the bottom. Okay. Number one, that's the thing that I'm going to address. There is always some truth in that. There is truth in that statement. You know, you've got to see things. You have to see things as they unfold, but you have to have your exits to be able to step aside. And then I shift them back. Okay, look, you're 60, you're 62 years old, you're 65, you're 70. Okay. We can go back clearly and show valuations are extremely high. Okay. So let's go back to that CSV dashboard and I'll try to walk everybody through this just to lay this data out. And I can't move my mouse, so I'll do my best to talk everybody through where we are. I want to come back and say, okay, why do you value how do you value the market? I mean, you have to just from mathematics because you've got to invest today for present value for future cash flow. When you're buying a company, the only thing that you're buying is the future earning capability of that company from an investment standpoint. Now, on the right-hand side here, and I know this is hard to see for everybody, I'll try to talk you through it. This is the aggregate market value index model that's developed by this current market valuation. So it's a combination of all the big ones. Red is up here is 2 standard deviations overvalued, and down here is low. Well, yeah, I mean, okay, I got ahead of myself. So let's just go back to the 1960s. Okay, I can't move my mouse or I'll lose it. I can go over there and try to find it. But this tells us that on September 30th of 1968, that the market was 1 standard deviation overvalued. Okay, so it just means it's an expensive market. You're paying a huge premium for the future earnings of those companies. And this always happens in the investor cycle when people get overly optimistic. Okay, and they don't. The optimism overtakes the reality of the underlying situation. Mm-hmm. And that's just a weakness in our human nature. Okay, so I'll try to find that spot. Before I lose the spot, I'll tell you, the actual 10-year return of the S&P 500, now I moved to November 30th, 1968, still in the same area. The actual 10-year return for the S&P 500 from November 30th of 1968 to November 30th of 1978 was a 13% loss. Okay, so okay. I'll try to find that on the scatter plot. So what that tells us is that's the starting point over here on the scatter plot and the actual outcome for the 10 following years. Okay. So that was in the 1960s. Now let's go over here to the year 2000. So that was October 31st of the year 2000. Now, we've talked about that. And why do we bring that up? Because it's ridiculously important, because the same type of environment then, slightly different, is the same as it is now. And you're looking at market valuation driven by euphoria, because investors are overly optimistic that market was expensive. Okay, so is that the point that you want to be maximally aggressive? No. No, you don't, if you're paying attention to the mathematics. But you, if you get into the narrative and you get up the fear of missing out, and the fear of missing out is far greater than the fear of losing money for people, because people cannot stand to watch other people seemingly prosper when they don't. Mm-hmm. Now, if we look at to the left, so that was February 29th of the year 2000, the actual 10-year subsequent return, there we go. February 29, 2000. The actual subsequent 10-year return was a 19% loss for the S&P 500. And I'll see if I can find that data.
And by the way, that was
here.
That same 10 years where Warren Buffett was now a hero again after being a goat just prior.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he lost 19% in approximately 19 in 1999, but he was up 38% over the next 3 years when the S&P went down 47. Because investors flooded back to those same stocks that they sold. So, yep. You know, when you look at that, this is where we are now. Well, I don't have a 10-year outcome, but you have to assume that it is completely different this time, because this is mathematics that go through all kinds of cycles, okay? So where do you want to be aggressive? You want to be aggressive when the market's fairly valued. So this is June 30th of 1982. Mm-hmm. The market was undervalued. But guess what, Chris? In 1982, you could get treasury bonds or CDs paying somewhere in the neighborhood of 17-18%.
I know.
Okay, you could. So investors were like, why would I carry the market risk after the calamity that occurred from 1970 to 1982 when I can get 17% guaranteed? Okay, so the exact opposite was what they should have done. And that's why valuations matter. They can't predict the outcome or what it's going to be, but they give you an indication that this is where you should be more aggressive. The actual subsequent 10-year return of the S&P from June 30th of 1982 till June 30th of 1992, including the 87 crash, was 272%. Okay, and then you go back to the year, 2009. But most investors are looking back and they assume that the returns from 2009 till today are going to continue going forward without realizing. Retail doesn't know this. They don't really care. They're all into options and short-term thinking and, believing that they can get out of this. And, I've shared my concern that I'm scared of options, because I do believe that we're going to have some issues in the derivatives market and that those puts are not going to pay out the way that they expect them to. I hope they do, but my concern is the risk is too high right now. So yeah, the actual 10-year return from March 31st, 2009 forward was 199%. But look, we're at a completely different starting value. So, that kind of takes me back when you were talking about Chipotle was selling at 35 times earnings.
Right.
I encourage every investor to go to your local bank and say, hey, I want to buy this local restaurant. Their earnings are $1 million a year. I got to pay them $35 million because, they're popular and people like them. No bank's going to loan you the money. They're not. But the difference on Wall Street is you as investors are going to throw them into these bond funds. They got to do something with it, or into equities. And these euphorias cause them to be overvalued. And then investors wonder why they don't have really good returns over the long term, and that makes passive look really attractive, because their emotions force them to pile in at the worst time and to sell at the worst time.
I want to back up a second, though. So let's imagine somebody comes in with one of these portfolios. You've got this context, but you're not willing to Warren Buffett it and just park them in cash for the moment. How do you do that? Like, how do you manage that for them?
Okay. So that's
You're not trying to pick a top or a bottom, but you're trying to manage the risk, right?
So that's a really good question. So there are a couple of things that we have to do when we're working with individuals individually. And actually, I'm shot an email to a client this morning that has a particular stock that's showing all kinds of warning signs. They have ridiculous gains that are inside of there. They wanted to err to holding it a little bit longer so they could defer those capital gains. So when we first started working together, I said, look, here are your exit points. This is the point where the price drops and money flow, volume, all of these things that come along that tell us that you need to be concerned. And each individual has to determine how much downside risk they're willing to embrace. Because here's the thing. Volatility is not your enemy when the market's undervalued. Volatility is not your enemy when an asset is in a bull market. That's what you have to embrace. That's one of the reasons why, even in technical analysis, it can increase your odds of success. But too many people think that it's going to give them perfect outcomes. It's not. It's just a tool to help you make prudent, wise decisions. So I'm going to deliver that to them. And then the first thing that I'm going to do with most people, and this is what I tell them, you know, we have to play the game by the rules that are forced upon us. Okay. I have to have one foot close to the exit. But if I step out too early, very few investors can stand sitting on the sidelines for 36 months when they're earning 4% if the S&P is doing 20 a year. Now, most clients, when you take them through a really good retirement plan and you show them where they need to be, if they have to carry that risk, then we're going to adapt for their situation to carry that risk more. And we're going to exit more all at once instead of dial that risk down. For most people, they're on track. They just don't need to blow up. So we'll peel that risk back a little bit. You know, in a lot of our strategies right now, we're only 70% invested. Returns have been good in a lot of them for the year. But I look at the client and say, hey, if the S&P does 20 and you do 14 or 15, just picking numbers, guys. I'm not saying what strategies do. This is just hypothetical talk. Are you going to be so upset that you exit the journey? If that puts you in a position to where if the market goes down 40 or 50, it's not different this time, that maybe you only lose 5 or 10%. And you have that conversation and you're continuing to educate them through. So it's very personal to each circumstance. But, you know, and I communicate to them, hey, you know, this is the line in the sand. And that line, if the market keeps going, that line's going to continue to grow. But this is the line in the sand where the information changes and we need to be worried. So right now I'm in the process of a communication campaign. You know, a lot of our clients are listening to us here is like, hey, I'm really concerned. I can build the argument that this is going to go for another 24 months, but I want you to know I'm going to err to hitting that sell trigger immediately when we cross some of these decision point lines to preserve your capital. And that may mean we get washed out right here at the top, but then I go back to the long-term data and say it is prudent to be conservative here. It's easy to look back in history and say, well, gosh, I'd have looked at that information in the year 2000. We had this hindsight bias thing. Once information comes out that we thought we knew, we tell ourselves that we knew, right? I can look back at the year 2000. It's hard not to say, well, I knew, but you don't know in the midst of it because you don't know what the future is and it's impossible to pick that top. So I just point back there and say, okay, with the information that we have now back in the year 2000, would it have been prudent to sell even if you were 6 to 12 months early? And everybody's like, yeah. Well, then why is it any different at this point now? Because the market has clearly cycled throughout history. That's why we have a consistent rhythm of bubbles that occur, but they don't occur at the exact intervals because of different forces that are in there. So that's what I just try to do is educate clients and say, hey, look, here's the thing. You know, let's change this a little bit. Well, I don't want to sell. I'm going to pay taxes. Okay, well, let me tell you about a client that I had back in the year 2007. I didn't have discretion. They own Wachovia Bank stock. It had been passed down for three generations. Okay. So there was tons of emotional attachment to it. This individual's net worth at the time was $3.3 million. And $3 million of it was in Wachovia stock. Okay. I think I can talk about it because they're bankrupt now. They don't exist anymore. So I'm like, look, please, we've got all kinds of concerns that are here. Sell half of it. Okay. Just park it to the side, diversify a little bit. Well, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to pay taxes. So I go through the argument that, hey, you know, paying taxes, yeah, you're going to pay 20% long-term gain. Well, my grandfather would be upset if I sold that. Well, the dividends are great. And I'm like, you just don't understand. Go back to the year 2000, show them examples of stocks that collapse and the dividends go away. So you can't guarantee that those dividends are there if this is as bad as what we think it'll be. You know, and oh, by the way, here's Chris Martinson's analysis on the housing market. You helped me a lot back then, Chris. So, but the answer was no. So I had them sign five papers. You know, thinking that usually if I have a client sign a piece of paper, it says, look, I've given you the information. You need to sign this that I've warned you. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But the risk analysis tells us there's a huge amount of downside risk. So no action was made. I get a call when it had dropped to a value of about 80,000. Okay. And there've been all kinds of talks all the way down to this point.
Ouch. Such a painful story.
Here's where I was wrong. So on Thursday, you know, before I'm like, look, at this point, this is not the point to sell right here, right? You've had maximum pain. At least wait for some bit of a bounce. I mean, that's just the right thing to do when you reach that point. And I said, I think they're fine in the interim period because we were starting to see signs that the market was starting to bottom. I said, I think we're fine unless there's a bank run at some point here in the next weekend. Of course, there was a bank run on Wachovia on that weekend, and they go down. They ended up with a little bit when Wells Fargo took them over, if I remember correctly. But that's the example of conversations that we try to have with people. And, you know, there was no, the individual, because I had communicated so clearly, there was no anger towards me because I gave them every opportunity. But I couldn't make the decision for them because they didn't give me the fiduciary position to do it. Now, the good thing is I'll have conversations with clients now, and it's a lot easier because we have discretion. I lay out the plan. I can pull the trigger for them as long as they agree to the plan ahead of time. So we're both on the same page, and that helps them not get caught up like a deer in the headlights of all the emotions that they feel over time. So, that's a long-winded answer. But it's conversations with clients, showing them where they need to be, showing them this is the maximum amount of risk. That's why the retirement plan is so important and why we do that for everybody. Okay. You're on track. Are you going to be more concerned because you miss a little opportunity in the interim period, but you're successful at the end, than you are trying to hit that maximum value at the end of your life? But you also run the risk of running out of money by the time you're 80.
Well, this is why you need somebody with a few gray hairs, been there, done that, not our first rodeo, you know, because it's not a new era, right? Oh, no, it must be a new era, Paul. Jeff Wenninger right here, if you make a basket of supermarket food companies, so that's Campbell's, General Mills, Clorox, Conagra, typical, you know, consumer staple, little bit defensive stocks. Their stocks have lost relative to the S&P 500 by 38.9% per year for the last 3 years. So this is a relative valuation. So if you're in basic necessities, oh gosh, we hate those. Those have no part in our portfolio because obviously this is all about technology and, you know, yada, yada, and all that other stuff. But that's kind of interesting to me that, like, underneath the market we've talked about, Paul, there's a lot of pain down there, right? There's a lot of zombie companies and poor earnings. And it's really just this new era talk about these one sets of big companies. So even when we talk about the S&P 500, I always have an asterisk in my head because people talk about that. How's the index doing? It's not the index. It's how are these hyper-concentrated 10 companies doing, right? And are there any cracks in that particular story? And that's what we need to understand because people get attached to the market. It's not a market anymore. It's a market, right?
That's right. That's right. Now, I want to follow up on that, but I have to do one thing to make sure that I'm meeting the regulations, because anytime I use an example of where we advise somebody good, I got to use bad, because that's true.
Okay.
Okay, so I've had clients that have come in, and they've been 80% in one stock, and I'm like, that's too much risk. Let's cut you back to 20, and then the stock doubles or triples in the 10 years that follows on the other side of that. Okay, so, I mean, but it's still the prudent thing to do, and those clients are not angry. We're still working together, but they do give me a hard time, say, you know, if I'd have just stayed fully invested in that stock, that's going to happen. But the problem is when you're fully invested, the large majority of your wealth in one company, you're not diversified and you have to speculate on the future. Okay. So I met my requirements of showing a bad one with a good one. This is what I want to show you here going along with that, those stocks being kicked aside. This is a really good summary from Samantha Ludog. I like her work. She said, I know consensus polls don't care, but we have a worsening K-shaped economy for Americans and clearly a K-shaped economy for American firms. Per Apollo, earnings expectations have increased for the Magnificent Seven and declined for every other company in the S&P 493.
Declined.
Every other company in the S&P 493, earnings expectations have declined, but the Magnificent Seven are the only ones that are increasing.
So that's Tom not Dorsey, K-shaped, but I can't think of anything that actually articulates that shape.
Yeah, I don't know how.
I'm out of metaphors.
So that's a really messed up K. You've got right at the top of the stick on the side. You've got a little bit. Everything else is down.
Yeah.
And that goes back to Tom Dorsey years ago, back in 2007. One of the things he was warning about, he said the only ones left on the field are the generals. So, okay, so you've got a good battle and a good army when you've got the generals that are out there on the front instead of the back offices like they are today. Mm-hmm. You get the generals on the front line and all the soldiers right behind them. But how good are those generals going to do if they're focused on the battle and all the soldiers have left? So we're in a situation right now where you've got these generals that represent, let me see, I've got the chart here, I want to find it.
I think we did this last time, but it's something ridiculous, like 33% of the S&P is just the generals.
Well,
50%,
maybe
54% of the NASDAQ, just the generals.
Yeah, like so 22% is in the 22% is in the top three. Peter Malluch, the S&P 500 has never been more concentrated in just three stocks than it is today with NVIDIA, Microsoft, and Apple. 22%. Of the index.
That's just three.
That's just three.
Yikes.
Okay. So that means for every dollar, for every $100,000 you put into the S&P 500 right now, 22% of it's going into NVIDIA, Microsoft, and Apple.
Yikes.
Okay. So those are the generals that are there. So yeah, I mean, you know, but it also presents an unbelievably good opportunity, Chris. And I know I'm going on and on about this. When your value stocks have been taken out of the woodshed beat when they're fundamentally attractive, they're just not popular, okay? So I like to use this analogy. Everybody think back to high school and college, okay? High school, you had really popular kids that did no studying. In college, you had really popular kids that did no studying. And you had some popular kids that did studying, you know, they're gifted in all areas. But when everybody gets in their mid-30s, especially over most of our lives looking back and the economy that was there, those who put in the work and might not have been as popular in the high school and college period of time are in really a much better position in most cases. And even now you look back, you know, some of the kids that weren't quite as popular and didn't have the opportunity to go to college went into the trade schools. They're doing really good right now, right? Just because as the economy has changed. So, you know, I think there's incredible opportunity in a lot of these companies. Now, am I willing to go pile into them right now? No, because if the market sells off, they're probably going to go down further. But the moment that they show stability and give me some money flow and start to revert back to the mean, then we're going to deploy pretty aggressively in those areas. So I want people to understand, just because the market comes apart doesn't mean that there's not opportunities out there. Nearly every major market decline that we've had, there's always been two, three, or four, or five stocks that come into the stock strategies that have been good performers. Maybe it's not for the first 6 months, but you know, you go back to the things people were selling in 1999 that were value, which is the style of investing that Buffett was in, caught supply and demand, just more sellers than buyers because they were chasing the theme, the new dream, caused him to go down. But when the other theme came apart, people came back to value, prudence, long-term mathematic reality, and Buffett rewarded those investors that stayed with him over that period of time. Hopefully that's what we do. You don't know how it's going to work, but when you look at Buffett right now being that aggressive as a net seller for approximately 24 months, that much cash, making statements like he did, that we're financially and emotionally in a position to take advantage of the chaos that others are just passively riding through, that's how you separate yourself from a long-term standpoint. There's a time to stay with the herd, and then there's a time to slowly creep away from the herd. And for everything we do in our lives, discipline, sacrifice, and emotional management, leads to good fruit down the road. So we, you know, I wish investors would stop with this instant gratification, really understand and listen to what you're trying to warn people about, what I'm trying to warn people about, and others are, that this is a time to be very careful. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. You know, there's a time to fully go into the debasement trade. Right now, I'm more concerned about return of capital through this cycle than I am return on capital. Now, that doesn't mean that we're zero invested. We're playing the game by the rules that are forced upon us, but we're finger on the trigger as we start to see continued evidence that the market starts to care and this rolls over. And that means we're not going to pick the top. We're just not going to.
Paul, I want to get to that debasement trade, and I also want to talk about how I think, you know, I just interviewed Ed Dowd, and he's all in on this idea that we're going to see this big deflationary outcome. That's what nobody's positioned for, because everybody thinks the Fed's going to reflate. But there is enormous, enormous pressures going that are deflationary right now. I want to talk about those just as soon as we come back from this message. Today's markets are more volatile than ever. With ongoing economic and geopolitical uncertainty, navigating such environments requires thoughtful, adaptive strategies, not a one-size-fits-all approach. At Peak Financial Investing, our registered investment advisory firm connects clients with experienced wealth managers who focus on active portfolio management. These professionals use evidence-based strategies designed to respond to changing conditions, not outdated formulas, but customized approaches grounded in research, discipline, and risk awareness. We believe in open, informed conversations, including discussing tools like precious metals and diversification as part of a broader financial strategy. Every investor's situation is unique, and our advisors tailor their guidance accordingly. Visit peakfinancialinvesting.com today to schedule your free consultation and explore how proactive management can support your financial goals. I'm Dr. Chris Martinson, proud to work with Peak Financial Investing, and my support reflects my professional views. I encourage you to take control of your financial future by making informed decisions. All right, welcome back, everybody. We're going to get to that deflation, but first, to set that up, Paul, I don't know, you must have seen this. Let's listen into this together. This is the most astonishing thing. This is literally unbelievable to me.
H-1B visa thing will not be a big priority for your administration, because if you want to raise wages for American workers, you can't flood the country with tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands
of foreign
workers.
I agree, but you also do have to bring in talent.
We don't have talented people here. You don't have certain talents, and people have to learn.
You can't take people off an unemployment line and say, I'm going to put you into a factory where we're going to make missiles, or I'm going to put
you... How did we ever do it before?
Wow.
I loved her question.
Wow. What do you mean, Trump? We don't have talented people? No, we don't. No, you don't. We don't have talented people. We just don't have talented people.
Wow.
That is a kind of a shocking thing. So right now, let me see if I brought it in here. I think I did. So Mark Mitchell, who runs Rasmussen Reports, I know Mark, he's a great guy, and so he's got, if you go to his, it's Honest Pollster, at Honest Pollster on Twitter, if people go there, he has probably 50 of these. So these are people, after he talked about the H-1B thing, just texted him or DM'd him their experiences. And so here's a guy who said, quote, I work for a company you probably think's an American company. To illustrate the problem with tech so people have real numbers, I have a daily meeting with 37 people on it. 22 of them are Indian, with at least 7 of them being H-1Bs. I have a second meeting for onshore devs, developers, to discuss new tech that we are encountering. 22 devs on this meeting, 9 are H-1Bs. I've been pushing the team to hire new grads for 6 years, so we hired 3 new grad software engineers, all female. One of them, and I'm not exaggerating, could not program, as in could not write a simple if statement. I work with her for an hour a day for 3 weeks, trying to get her to understand she needed to be putting in the hours outside of work until she finally quit. They hired another dev after that, another female. Only 22% of new grad software devs are female, so we hired 4 in a row. This is why young men are so mad. We're getting replaced by H-1Bs on one end, and on the other, the entire 22% of females, even if they literally cannot write code, get hired before a man is hired, and this is part of that overall pressure that's happening And let me see if I captured. No, I didn't put that in. But So what I wrote about that is, you know, when a country fails its young, it's betraying its own future. Right now, the unemployment rate for 20 to 24-year-olds is 9.2%. And that's the highest level since 2016, excluding the COVID period, which was weird. So we have nearly 10% unemployment for 20 to 24-year-olds. And the president is telling them they're not getting hired because they're not qualified and we don't need you.
Wow.
Wow. What a betrayal.
Unbelievable. And what a demoralization. You're speaking something over a future generation and telling them that they cannot, and words have power. And the reality is they can. You've just got to fix the institutions to stop giving everybody trophies and go back to choosing people on the merits of their ability. And that ability sharpens with demanding that they do the work, you know, and strengthening them mentally instead of, here, you get a trophy just because you participated.
Well, worse, you get a trophy because you've participated in our identity politics. Like I've seen, shocked. People started posting pictures of like insides of classrooms. They look like little indoctrination centers. It's all about these various isms and nothing to do with reading, writing, arithmetic, right? It's all about ideological conformity. And so great, you produce people who are really good at conforming to whatever the latest fad is intellectually, but that's not the rigorous training they need to compete, you know, in open marketplace of rough and tumble. Like you gotta know how to work, right? So it ain't, but I think I diagnosed the problem. I think it's this. Look at the percentage of Congress over the age of 70, just like skyrocket starting around 2000. It's like this, it's like an old folks home there now. And, you know, I'm speaking to somebody who'll be 70 myself if I live long enough, you know, and I get it, but maybe it's time. I really feel like the youth have been sort of like sacrificed here. And I just think that's we're betraying our own future when we do that. I'm worried we're not really thinking this through, kind of like building dark data centers. There's a little something missing in this conversation that we need to have, right?
Right. Well, but, and the thing, yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Well, the youth are becoming a potent political force. They're starting to get kind of restive and activated. Mm-hmm. And so this is going to have political ramifications. Again, as I intro'd this at the beginning, Paul, my concern. Trump's trying to do some really aggressive things, get lots of foreign investment in the United States, reset the world stage. It's a new global order. America's going to be at the center. The dollar's going to retain its primacy. And you're going to have to take some really painful steps to get through that, because that's what a new strategy requires. So you need as much political power as you can get. He just said, I don't care about my base. This is not America first. Putting H-1B people in is not America first. He also said he wants to open up U.S. universities to, I forget the number, 600,000, 900,000 Chinese. Again, not America first.
Yeah, no.
Right? So that political base of the, he's like, hey, if you're 18 to 24, don't care about you. Mm-hmm. You can't build a political thrust when you abandon the young. You just can't.
No, you can't. And they're going to turn and they're going to rebel and they're going to seek any alternative path because they're not being recognized. They're not being seen. They're not being mentored. They're not being taught. You know, and unfortunately, one of the things that I see in a lot of cases is it's very interesting because there's been a lot of mentorship from the older generations in the past. And we don't see much of that anymore. You know, there's love for family, but there's not mentorship in a lot of families that are out there. And that's just a sign of kind of the society that we're in right now. It's more interest in me than it is the future of the families, because they think that they've got enough wealth that wealth will just take care of them without listening to the warning of the past that wealth rarely makes it past three generations. You've got to give the next generation more than just money. You have to give them the emotional strength. You have to give them the fortitude, the problem-solving skills, and the encouragement to fight through hard times, because hard times create better people.
They do. And I mean, look at the percent of 30-year-olds who were both married and homeowners from 1950 to 2025. And it went from over 50% in 1950, probably looks like about 55%, down to under 15%. I don't know what number that would be, 12, 13% probably. That's astonishing. But we had this enormous erosion right here. At the same time, we had this enormous explosion in old people in Congress. I mean, it's just like, maybe we should have representation of, by, and for the people who are a little bit closer in age to you, because this is I really do feel like we have to have a larger conversation, which is around what kind of a future we're leaving behind and how we accomplish that. And it won't work if you have an older generation that's just desperately clinging to their fair share and has no interest in the younger generation. To your point, mentorship, but all kinds of things around this. You know, my largest critique of the Federal Reserve was they decided to bail out the housing market by running interest rates down and buying mortgage-backed securities to create more artificial demand for mortgage products so that house prices could stay high, because they said, you know, the wealth effect of having people feel like they're living in a valuable asset is that important. And they overlooked the idea that that excluded people who wanted to get into buying houses. They threw them under the bus. Such a short term thinking that it was really offensive to me. You know, just no. You don't make houses more expensive so that the people already living in them feel better. That's right. That's not a legitimate social outcome, you know, if you wanted to architect outcomes.
No. And at the base of it, it's pride, it's arrogance, you know, and two of my favorite scriptures are there's a way that seems right to a man, but its end leads to death. Okay. There's a way that seems right. Nobody's going to head down a path intentionally that produces bad fruit, but they're blinded because of overconfidence, pride, lack of humility. If you pair the other scripture that says, work out your faith with fear and trembling, you know, that's a picture of, hey, okay, I think this path is right. And we do this all the time in developing our strategy, allocation of capital. You know, what are we missing? What's the risk that we don't see? What do we think we know that we don't? Okay. Each step with fear and trembling doesn't mean that you're living in fear all the time, because the Bible does tell us don't fear, but it tells you to seek wisdom, you know, because we all miss the mark. Everybody sin missing the mark. All of us are going to sin. But if you understand that there's a way that seems right, you have to really analyze that and take each step with fear and trembling, reassessing the information. You're going to do far better than you are if you're just arrogantly walking through with pride, unknowing pride, especially because it also tells us, we know pride comes before the fall. And that's my concern of where we are right now. You've got a whole generation of politicians that have been in the single best economic backdrop that we've had. When I look back at the back testing throughout history, a convergence of all things that came together to be a great blessing to this generation. And yes, they had work ethic that worked hard for it that are in the lead. But I believe that there's an overconfidence that they believe things are a certain way just because that's what they've experienced, because they miss the lack of humility of looking back and really paying attention to the lessons of the past and asking themselves, are we really different? Are we really special? Or were we just lucky at this period of time to be born? And if we happen to be lucky, then we really need to pay attention to the decisions that we're making so that we can pass down to the next generation the opportunities that we had, or mitigate the outcome of the cycles that we find ourselves in historically so that they have a better chance of recovering quicker.
That chart you have behind you there, it reminds me of one of my favorite demotivational posters. Maybe I should buy it. It says, nothing fails like success.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you have all this success and you attribute it to, hey, it must have been me, you know, and if you're honest, luck of the draw, right? Mm-hmm. Right place, right time, plus some hard work. But if you leave out those first two, you start to think it was me, you know, I was the one who did that,
Right.
Well, nothing fails like success.
Who was it that wrote the book? And it's a fascinating book. Oh my gosh, I wish I could think of the name of it. But the wisdom in it is incredible. And whoever wrote it, and I'm so sorry that I can't think of it, I'll probably find it. It's in my bookshelf stored in some boxes back there. But basically he goes through and he highlights Bill Gates and Apple's founder, Steve Jobs. And he says, we look at them and we celebrate the success that they had. But the reality is they were born at a time to where they ended up in college at a time where the convergence of information and technology came in, and they had a desire and a knack for that place. And they were in that window to where they rode the wave because of the skill set and the finding that they had of where they were. Had they been 10 to 12 years early, it'd be different names that we recognize. If they were 10 to 12 years earlier, they would have missed that window. And we all have to take that into consideration. A lot of our success is, yes, the benefit of discipline, hard work, and effort, and problem solving, and fighting through those tough periods of time. But the reality is, hyper success, you have to do the right things and be at the right place at the right time. And that's why I like to go through, I tell clients, past performance is not indicative in any way of what your future outcome is going to be, because you're going to have a completely different economic backdrop and in a completely, you know, ever changing economic environment. So you're going to have to be able to adapt to that. Right.
Yep. Now, Paul, I've gone to a lot of real estate conferences over time because it's a great asset class, and it's many asset classes. Real estate isn't a thing, right? So, I mean, there's multifamily, single family, commercial, all that, right? Okay. But just even 2 years ago, I was listening to people say rents go up. They just don't do anything but go up. And I saw people build into their pro formas this idea that rents were going to go up like double digits forever, right? And that's why this is an attractive apartment complex, all this and that. Ed Dowd had a different view of this when I interviewed him a year ago. He said, hey, people are discounting when you bring in 20 million illegal migrants, right? That creates, they have to go live somewhere. That creates all this pressure that they bump people out of this layer, so they have to get up into the next layer, and it creates all that upward pressure. And so these people were just sort of considering this like this trend that was just a law of nature, when in fact mm-hmm. it was being fueled and funded by the pressures of bringing in tens of millions of people. Well, Nick Gehrli writing now, the weakness in the rental market is alarming, he says, on November 10th, suggests there's much more deflationary pressure in the housing economy than people understand, and that in 2026 is going to be a year where CPI actually drops, because 33% of the inflation calculation is based on owner equivalent rent. It's a rental cost estimate. Whether you're experiencing more expensive stakes or not is irrelevant, because we're going to see this huge drag from this. But this is going to be enormously deflationary. So it's deflation, and then it's quantitative easing, of course. And then that leads back to inflation. Zero Hedge saying, October inflation unexpectedly crumbles amidst biggest drop in rents in 15 years. So there's a force going on here. I think it is related to the illegal migrant pressure. We don't have a million people. What was it? Something ridiculous. Like 2 to 3 million people a year at the height of Biden's thing coming into the country.
That number sounds correct based on what I've read, yeah.
Yeah.
2 to 3 million a year.
That we knew about, right?
And giving them taxpayer dollars so that they can go out and rent places. Like giving them tons of capital to expend.
Yep.
And if somebody's giving you money, you're not going to spend it conservatively. Look, I've been in the investment business for 27 years. I can't tell you how many conversations I have with clients of like, look, your child is not sacrificing their life in any way, and you're giving up your future ability to provide for yourself to support a lifestyle that your kid can't afford. And here's what's going to happen. When you run out of money, they're going to run out of phone calls to you because your usefulness to them. And look, I know that's a cynical outlook, mm-hmm. but I've seen it. I've seen it in 27 years. Okay. So when you're giving them government funds, that's a ton of capital that's working its way through. And if you get that in control and you get the illegal immigrants out of there, yeah, there's going to be some deflation and potentially overbuilt in the housing market.
Yeah. Well, it makes a lot of sense. So, and by the way, housing was due for a fall anyway, because we've mm-hmm. gone over it many, many times here on this program. Three things had to happen in some combination. Mortgage interest rates had to fall a lot. House prices had to fall a lot, or incomes had to go up a lot. Those were the options, and it was going to be some combination of those. But right now, it looks like the cost of rentals is dropping, which means that's going to put downward pressure on the investment side of the housing market, both multifamily, single family. So with that, well, we're going to get a deflation. If that deflation spills over into a popping AI bubble, this will be, pick your time frame, right? 2000 again, 2007, 8, whatever your numbers are. And we all know what's going to happen next. The Fed's going to try and print one more time, but we've already seen Trump float the idea of a $2,000 stimmy check for all Americans, he said, right? That's 330 million people. Then they skinnied it back to, well, maybe it's, percent came out the next day. It was like, maybe that's a tax credit. And now today we got more. They said, well, it's for anybody earning less than 100,000. Later, they're going to have to say anybody with a paycheck, because we didn't mean to imply your kids too, right? They're going to keep skinnying that down till they get somewhere, right? But think about that messaging again, Paul. It's basically saying, look, if you are somebody who's earning a lot and contributing a lot, when we try and give back money to this country, we're going to exclude you. We're only going to include these people, right? Which again is picking winners and losers. It's say what you want. It might be socially fair, but it's not equitable in the sense of saying we're treating all people equally,
right?
So it's a different conversation to have, but that happened over and over again in my lifetime, right? Mm-hmm. Where because I'm a small business person, I pay the highest possible taxes, the highest possible tax rate I can possibly be shoved into at the state and federal levels, right? Because that's how they want to treat the small businesses. When there was some kind of a stimmy check, I haven't received one yet. Not one in my entire life, right? Well, I'll take, okay, I've been successful. But again, the point is, if you think about people being given signals, the signal is, well, why go out and work, right? Signal to Wall Street, too big to fail. We even saw Sam Altman of OpenAI come out and say, well, we're so big now that the government can't let us fail. That's one end. And then on the other end, it's like, well, why shouldn't I just like fall under the line? Look, it's not a great life, but I don't have to do anything. And it's on that basis, it's pretty good, you know, just sit at home and collect whatever the government's going to give me. And then that middle just keeps getting squeezed and squeezed. And then they're told, you don't matter. You don't have the skills that are necessary. We don't care about you. And that's where the political pressure is starting to build.
Yes. Look, and I'll tell you, there's a lot of people that had a lot of hopes with Trump that he has crushed those hopes, and their anger is justified, really. Because it's one thing if you expect somebody to tell you one thing and do another. It's another thing if you actually have hope in that message that we're going to take care of our citizenry, and then they immediately do the opposite thing.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. So if they give out $2,000 stimmy checks, even if it's just to that narrowed window, it's still going to be $300 billion. It's still going to be $300 billion that fundamentally I'm going to have to pay for directly and then indirectly, because it's going to create inflation again, right? So it's just basically saying, hey, we're going to just keep squeezing you. Let us know when it's too much. But you're right. I'm hearing those people are starting to squeal a little and say that's, you can feel it. It's really building, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah. And the answer is, instead of letting things revert back to the mean to where they should, which will make it more affordable, hey, let's do 50-year mortgages. And yes, I know the payment isn't dramatically less. I can't remember the percentage off the top of my head right now. But that does create demand for some people that can get out there. But what's the next answer? 7,500-year mortgages? They also floated the idea of 15-year car loans. I mean, come on. That's just another way of, by 2030, you'll own nothing and be happy. Like the WEF told us a while ago, you know, we all thought that the collapse was going to occur. We probably get a combination of both. And then you've got individuals that are just making payments to the bank, you know, for the rest of their life, because they're never going to be able to accumulate enough money or have enough income with AI coming along and the deflationary pressure on wages. So now we're just going to have you as a indebted individual for the rest of your life.
Exactly. So Robert Kiyosaki really helped me, because I grew up, I was marketed to, and I bought the story. You know, he does this in these, if you were ever at one of his events, he would say, okay, just quickly get me a balance sheet, write down all the assets you have, and people write down stuff, right? He said, okay, anybody out there put your home as an asset, and all these hands go up. He's like, yeah, your home's not an asset. Mm-hmm. Assets put cash in your pocket. Liabilities take cash out of your pocket. Tell me how your home is putting cash in your pocket, right? And you can't, right? There's property taxes and interest and maintenance and all that stuff. It's just a cash hemorrhaging device. So when you look at that, when you have a mortgage, you don't own anything. You do not own that. You do not own that asset. As long as, even if there's just one mortgage payment left on it, you do not own that asset. The bank does. So 50-year mortgage is just basically saying, hey, you're going to rent it from this person instead of that person. 50 years, like, well, I'm 30, starting a family, get a 50-year mortgage. It'll be paid off when I'm 80. Come on. This is like, it's just so not right.
It's not. It's not. But, you know, obviously we don't have the willingness to allow what needs to take place, which could very well take place anyway. Okay, because those forces will revert themselves in a while. I do. I agree with Ed Dowd. My thesis has been that we're going to get some temporary deflation, which is going to provide the cover. I mean, can you imagine what's going to happen if the market's down 50% and a lot of these AI names have actually blown up, if that occurs? And then the response is going to be to print, print, print. Well, hey, we did a lot more during COVID than what we did during 2009. And I think that'll be the death knell for the dollar, and the debasement trade will be on. That's just my working thesis. We're going to have to adapt to that as information unfolds. But
I think gold agrees with you already, right? Mm. So it had went to almost 4,400, just under, corrected back down into 39, if you can even call it a correction, because I'm looking at it right now. It's back up close to 4,200 again, like just boink, straight back up again. But I wanted to talk about maybe this very quickly. I know we're going a little longer than usual today, but there's some things I just went over with Dave Russell at Gold Core, and I'm a fundamental person. I if I can understand it, Paul, I'm all in. Right, I just need to understand it. And so I've been a big fan of gold and silver for a long time. Gold for monetary reasons, because I trust you. You develop trust in somebody through at least one definition of trust, when they perform repeated consistent actions. So Paul, if you pick me up right at 8 o'clock 10 times in a row, I trust you're an on-time guy, right? Okay, fine. I trust that the Fed is going to print again. Sort of in the opposite negative expression of that. All right, there's that. But silver's been in a supply-demand deficit for 6 years running, and this will be year seven. Okay, it's just we're not mining as much as there is demand. And we just saw that the U.S. now has added officially copper and silver to critical minerals list. It's got a bunch of things on there. So now we're going to have to stockpile it or something. We don't know what that means yet. China's called it a critical thing. Russia has a strategic stockpile. And now we hear that 2025 could be the first year in history where 100% of mine output is going to industry. And if that sounds hyperbolic, we should consider that in 2024, 86% went to industrial output. So once you have 100% going to industry, Paul, there is zero left over for investment or jewelry or any of the other uses we might have out there. That's a huge, enormous turning point. I mean, that's a big moment.
That's a big moment. And right now, the data that I looked at recently is there's only 8 ounces of silver coming out of the ground for every 1 ounce of gold. Right?
Yep. Well, and silver is 70% of it that does come out of the ground is a byproduct of zinc mining, copper mining, something else, right? A base metal. And guess what? We're not opening new mines for copper and zinc because it's just too expensive. The prices aren't supportive of that. I've heard that copper has to be at least two, but more realistically, three times more expensive than it currently is to enable mines to go forward that they know about. It's just not. They can't make the numbers work till copper goes up a lot. That's fine. But when you decide you do want to open a copper mine, it's about a 10-year process. Permitting, where's the water going to come from, running in the infrastructure, you know, getting the electricity and power in. There's like a lot to it. You don't just open up a hole in the ground and copper comes out. So with that, when we finally get to that existential moment of like, there's not enough silver, there'll be that mad scramble. And it's very simple to me. This is the oldest commodity story in the book. Prices are going to have to go up a lot to get grandma's silverware out of the closet to support the demand.
And the price is going to have to go up a lot to where those that own it have been life-changing, where they can diversify into other areas to pull it out of their hands.
Yeah.
You know, and another thing, Chris, is I go back to that big investment company. They're allocating to silver now. What's going to further exacerbate this is price action momentum. So if that price, you know, let's say I'm not saying this is going to happen. I'm just using a hypothetical scenario. 12 months from now, silver is $100 an ounce. 24 months from now, it's 150. What's going to happen? You're going to have investors that are going to pile on that train. So you're, you know, as you get into that lower demand, lower supply, you're going to have more money that's chasing fewer goods. And that's the problem with all the money that's been printed. It's been going into these other assets. But when it starts chasing these materials, they're in limited supply because they're needed for the new economy being, you know, all of the technology that's coming in and the demand from the manufacturing process. It's hard to actually calculate how much upside potential would be there. But mathematically, yep, there's a tremendous amount to the upside right now.
I'll sell my silver at some price. I'd consider it. 900 an ounce, 1,000, I'll sell.
I would start thinking about it at that price for sure.
Yeah.
But, you know, and along the way, so here's the thing. Let's say we have a deflationary outcome and the economy really contracts in the short run. It wouldn't surprise me one bit to see silver have a massive smacking down to the downside, but that presents an opportunity for those who are disciplined and paying attention to the mathematics from a long-term standpoint to take advantage, to build upon their positioning. Because again, volatility is your friend as long as the fundamental mathematics work out for you. Volatility becomes your enemy when overvaluation gets in play. So you go back to the peak of gold back in, what was it, 19? What year did gold peak? 80? Was it 80? It wasn't 82. It was 80?
Well, 1980, it had its first little run up, right? From 35 up to, it's pretty 800, high, 800?
800, yep. 870. Maybe it peaked in 82. Whatever year the peak was, let's look at the mathematics back then. The value of gold was worth 125% of all dollars in circulation. That's a metrics at the time that tells you it's overvalued. Where we are right now, we're nowhere near overvalued, and investors are ridiculously underallocated.
Oh, it's worth what, 12, 13, off the top of my head, percent of dollars in circulation?
Yeah,
that we know about. So. That doesn't include magic money machine, Cayman Island stuff. We don't know.
That's right.
Yeah.
And the leverage in the derivatives market that's out there as well. So,
yeah.
This expanded money supply.
This is silver. So you can see it peaked back here in 81, I think. 80, 81. So it had that, but that was a super spike. And then we had our 2011 spike, and here we are. Actually, it's higher than that. It's at 51 right now. So right where my tip of my mouse is, about where it is right now. If it continues off, it just has a lot of room. There's nothing but air up there from a chart standpoint to take it away. So could go a lot higher. We'll see. But again, you know, my belief system on all this, Paul, is just simply that they're going to print. The government, like it's in Trump's instincts are, he doesn't want any weakness. So stimmy checks, deficit spending, whatever's necessary, you know, so that things don't look bad. The Fed, too. I think deep down they're deeply afraid that they have decades and decades of propping and pumping and fraudulently inflating the markets, and they're worried that there's a big air pocket under there that they don't know how deep it goes, right? And they don't want to explore that air pocket. I think that's where we're at.
Yeah. And they would rather continue the deception than they allow the truth to become reality, and the truth is always the best path. Mm-hmm. It's always the best path because that's the sustainable path from a long-term standpoint.
Right. Well, let's just to flesh that out. This is terrible from my perspective as somebody who, you know, technically I could be retired, but I don't see that happening for a while. But at this stage of my life, a big giant downfall and my portfolio gets shredded and all of what I think of as my wealth gets shredded. From a personal standpoint, I would go, wow, that's terrible. From my kid's standpoint, best thing that could ever happen.
Yeah.
So we have to ask, who is this story really about, you know? And I submit it's about my kids, not me.
Yeah, that's a very good point, because it's our responsibility to leave the next generation a skill set, more wisdom, and a foundation to where they can continue for the family line and our nation and our generations to where it's better. You know, we want it to be where, you know, the sun's continuing to rise for the next generation as we go along. And I understand that's not a great cycle because the sun will set at some point, But if they're prepared mentally, financially, and have a solid, sustainable foundation, then the pain of those cycles is going to be a lot less, and they'll have the emotional strength to come out that other side. Yeah, mm-hmm. You're right.
However, I still also believe that if you're prudent and nimble, you can see these things unfolding before they happen and get yourself at least partly, if not entirely, out of the way of that freight train that's coming, right? That whatever that thing looks like. And so I do think there are things people can and should do. Of course, that's why we do this program. That's why we're in relationship with each other around all this and fellowship around it. And it's my mission. I just want people to be aware. I think context is everything. Some people don't want to know the truth, and that's fine. I think they're going to find the outcome a lot more bitter than it needed to be than if they could just take the pain, face the truth, realize that no decision is a decision these days, and do something to take control of whatever you can control. Now, I can't control the Fed printing, but I can control what happens to me because of that printing.
And that's one of the things. We can't control the outcome, but we can control the effort, the wisdom, and the prudence we put into our decisions. And, you know, the harder you work, the luckier you are. Okay, luck has a lot to do with it, right place, right time. But if you're not putting in the work and you're not doing the sacrifice and you're not doing the research, which is what my job is to do for clients, I pray every day that the Lord will grant us wisdom and discernment to help be a blessing to those that we serve. I'm still going to look like a fool from time to time. That's just the nature of the industry that we're in. But the less mistakes you make when everybody's making major mistakes, the better your outcome is over time. And that's the problem where we are right now. I encourage investors, you know, we have to remember, you have to embrace courage. You have to embrace courage to see the truth. It's one thing to see the truth, but you have to have courage to accept the reality of the truth and then formulate a path or a decision-making protocol to where you take that first step towards the path less traveled. And like I said, there's time to be right with the herd. Party while you're partying when valuations are normal. Have a blast. But always take every step with fear and trembling as a picture, not fearfully, but looking for wisdom so that when it's time to really leave the party, walk that path less traveled, so that you're in a better situation for your family, for your community, for everywhere else. And that's what grieves me so much. You know, I don't believe in too big to fail. I don't. Because if you put yourself in a situation where you're too big to fail and the consequences across society, then it's your greed that puts you there and you shouldn't be bailed out. So your foolishness got you into that situation, which you think is wisdom. Let it come apart and then let the other people who've been doing the work with the discipline, the wisdom to step in, pick up those pieces and create the future that's sustainable from those who laid that foundation there, right? I mean, All that dark cable, that worked out from a long-term standpoint, but those companies absolutely got obliterated because they were foolish in the management of their capital. You know, let somebody else step in and utilize that foundation. Let them suffer the consequences of their gambling, right? And then we'll build up better innovation that's a lot more sustainable from a long-term standpoint.
And let's recall, of course, that if you have all your chips placed in the idea that it's a new era, right, where the economic laws have been suspended, right, you're exposed. You should probably have some of your chips on the other side of the table, which is has a sign over it that says, "This time is not different." It's humans and money, and it's the oldest story in the book, literally, and ever since money got invented. So we're there again, you know, and the warning signs are clearly there at this point. And so whether people heed them or not, that's up to them. But I'm really glad you're there doing what you do and helping people sort of navigate this, because it's super complicated, right? This is a lot harder than it should be, you know, because you have to not just fight the forces of what's true, what's false, what's the right narrative, where's the economy going, what are positive investments, but you have to fight this entity called the Federal Reserve that is there whipping you from behind by making sure that your money is losing value over time. So you have to play the game. They're like, "Get in the game." You're like, "I don't like the game." Tough. You're in the game, you know? I just think there ought to be a way. When you're 65, I think it ought to be that you don't pay property taxes anymore and your money is stable, you know, and not subject to theft and confiscation by inflation or by scamsters or whatever the story is, right? It's too complicated. So thank you for
it is
taking up that complication for people, because you got to be diligent. Man, you are a diligent guy. So happy
about
that.
Well, thank you. I try to be. I care deeply about the people that we have the opportunity to serve. And that drives me. I enjoy it. I enjoy the research, but it drives me. And just a reminder, you know, yes, it's complicated, but if you really enjoy doing the research, there's people that can do this themselves. You know, it's not rocket science. You just have to be diligent, disciplined, and control your emotions. We're here for the people who don't enjoy doing it themselves, or they can't find somebody that they trust that has a strategy that makes sense for them. You know, those are the ones that we serve. And then we lay the foundation by giving them that, you know, showing them, here's the reality of where you are, right? Once we settle on a good plan, you know, then we talk about, here's the risks to blowing up. Here's your options, path A or B. You know, which one makes the most sense for you? And then we go to work and helping them, you know, navigate that as successfully as possible. And I do have the benefit, you know, it's funny because when I got in the business, you know, I had a guy look at me one time and he's like, you know, everybody was like, well, you're young, you know, you're inexperienced. Well, one guy recognized the fact that I researched a lot and he says, well, I know you're not being complacent where you are because you're researching hard and I've carried that forward because that's our responsibility as a fiduciary for the clients that we serve. And that's how we demonstrate for them that we care about them, is putting that effort and that work in and communicating to them and helping them make wise decisions.
Well, for anybody who wants to speak with Paul or his amazing team, go to peakfinancialinvesting.com. Again, that's peakfinancialinvesting.com. Fill out a simple form. Somebody from Paul's team will get a hold of you within 48 business hours to set up the first call. If you like that call, it'll be followed up with a planning call. And if you like that, it'll finally progress to a recommendations call. So it's a big process you put people through. Make sure you can really help them, that they're in the right place, that both parties agree that this is going to be a good relationship. Because I know you're selective. You want to work with people who are really going to benefit from what you do. You don't want to have to fight through an alder thicket for every small decision with some people and other people. You know, you want them engaged and involved in that process as much as possible. Right. So I get that.
It's an honor. It's an honor. I'm good. Enjoying the journey.
Until next time, everybody, this has been Finance U. I hope you come back next week. Been great being here with you today. Please watch this at 2x speed and then at 0.5 speed, whatever you have to understand really where we are at this point in time. Until next time, I'm Chris Martinson, signing off.